In his new book, Gilded Rage, independent journalist and New York Times bestselling author Jacob Silverman delivers a searing expose on the radicalization of Silicon Valley, a peek behind the curtain at the tech and finance billionaires who are using their money and influence to steer a radical political revolution. As he follows men like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel from early days of PayPal and Palo Alto to Washington, D.C., Silverman uncovers a sinister world where moguls preach populist revolt while dismantling the few remaining checks on their influence. This is the book you need to understand our current political moment and how tech and politics have become dangerously intertwined. Gilded Rage is available October 7th from Bloomsbury Continuum. Get your copy wherever books are sold.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation Magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. We have a show this week that I am so excited about. We are going to have part one of a two-part series with two of the three editors of one of the most challenging boxing books I've read in some time. They are the editors of Rings of Dissent, Boxing and Performances of Rebellion. Terrific stuff. And this week we're going to talk to David Leonard. He's one of the three editors. He's also the author of Playing While White, Privilege and Power on and Off the Field, and After Our Test, incredible book, The NBA and the Assault on Blackness. Wow. I mean, he's done some great work for a very long time. And I'm very excited to hear what his politics and history have brought to the story of boxing that he wanted to convey. And then next week, we're going to talk to Rudy Mondragon. Rudy Mondragon is, I've known Rudy for a while. I've known Rudy since he was a student. Rudy makes me feel old. But I'll tell you this about
Rudy.
I'll tell you this about Rudy. His sharpness on this issue, the incisive way his mind works in understanding boxing, and a breadth of boxers, it's just endlessly impressive, and we're going to talk to Rudy next week. Also, this week, though, after I speak to David Leonard, talking to my man, the basketball savant, Arya Shirazi, where we're going to do our NBA awards picks this week, and I'm going to recant one of my final predictions, so you can listen to me already one game in, eat some humble pie, and change my pick, because I guess that's what neurotic sports people do. But I digress, and now let's talk to David Leonard.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave. It's always exciting to be with you and to have an opportunity to talk about sports and politics and life, as you've been doing for many years. And, you know, thinking back to reading your newsletter. And so it's always an honor to
Great,
be able
man.
To just to share space with you.
Yeah, right back at you. But I'm going to start you with a tough question because this ain't going to be a love fest.
Oh, no.
You know and I know that there are a lot of boxing books out there, some of them written by the most respected, not just sports writers, but writers in the English language. I mean, actually that's some amazing books in Spanish that are coming to mind as well about boxing. The point is, a lot of space has been taken up by this subject. What did you and Rudy Mondragon and Gay Teresa Johnson, what did you see in this landscape where you said, this is something that needs to be said that really hasn't been said yet?
I think, and you mentioned Rudy. I know for me, I feel like this project, I've been along the ride, and Rudy is the conductor of the train, but also the conductor of the symphony. And I mean, the project came out of his work and his dissertation of looking at boxing as a space of performance. And so we set out to create a book that did two things. One, to look at the various ways that boxing is a site of performance, from the press conference and the walkout to the actual performance in the ring to media to actually the place that various boxers have had throughout history. So I think there was that aspect of what bridges together a boxer in New Orleans who was passing with a contemporary boxer that's using their space and their craft to perform, to protest, to dissent. So I think there was that aspect of not, as you said, there have been so many amazing books on, obviously on Ali, on the history of boxing, on the history of race in boxing, on transnationalism, on the economics of boxing. And so we wanted to really think about kind of performance, but also do a book that was a performance itself.
Well, what makes the book a performance?
I think our choice, and this is part of why we it was such a journey to get it published, is we refused to limit ourselves to a particular style, a particular kind of. We have pieces that are very historical. We have pieces that are that by Javon Johnson, the professor and spoken word artist, that is a it is poetry. That just as Ali was poetry in the ring, this piece kind of embraces that aesthetic. We sought to include interviews, not just with, the legendary Max Kellerman, and Jessica Luther, kind of, who brought their various knowledges about boxing. Max, who has been at the forefront of boxing in for various networks for decades, and Jessica Luther, who in the interview talks about kind of a complex relationship with boxing, and then we have interviews with Jasiri X and Stickman, and so
So
to
just
me.
you refuse to be like, we're gonna be a book with 12 essays about history or 12 essays about the present. You are saying for us, form matters just as substance matters, and we want to have multiple forms in terms of how we relay our information because the form itself is a form of performance. Is
Yes,
that what I'm hearing from you?
that I think that's a great summary, is that so much of academic books perform a kind of narrow, not only a narrow way of presenting information, whether it be a collection or a monograph, but also very narrow ways of understanding knowledge and knowledge production, and see, whether it's data sets being the archives or elsewhere. We wanted to bring together voices that each had different relationships with boxing, and would bring their stories and their interactions with the archives or boxing in unique ways.
And unique it is. It's interesting though that you don't just say performance though. You say performances of rebellion. Because I think you would agree that every match, every lead up is a performance, even if the politics are reactionary, even if the politics are void from the proceedings altogether. But you're focusing on the performances of rebellion. What constitutes rebellion in a sport that is probably unparalleled in terms of its history of exploitation, oppression, and abuse?
I mean, I think we look at the varied ways that we can think about rebellion. That boxers who, in our current moment, and we've seen examples, but we probably there are lesser known examples, boxers who are being profiled by ICE, that merely showing up to not just the ring that is part of the boxing world, of fight night and professional boxing, but show up at those local gyms, are engaged in performance. I think that's why we have two chapters that look at the local gyms, both Gleason's and gyms in Los Angeles, because we recognize that that part of boxing history is as important as those unknown fights that happen every week that aren't on TV, where, as you note, boxers are making, less than minimum wage, given the amount of work that it takes. Not to mention those boxers who are at the elite level who are being exploited. So we see that those performances are resistant. We see that those who are seen and imagined as outside of the history of boxing, so LGBTQ boxers, women, who confront spaces where they're seen as undesirable. And so I think we imagine the many ways that resistance is happening. We see, I mean, in many ways, we're kind of bringing Robin Kelly's idea of the hidden transcript or James Scott's idea of infrapolitics, those everyday sites of resistance that are so important.
You just mentioned Robin Kelly, and you described the inner transcript,
Hidden
the
transcript.
hidden transcript. Give us a sense. Oh, let me, shit, if we're going to redo, I might as well redo that. You just talked about Robin Kelly and what he has deemed the hidden transcript that I guess you're applying to the rebellion that exists in boxing. Can you just say a little bit, though, about what that means, the hidden transcript?
Yeah, so Kelly, in his book Race Rebels, really pushes us to think about protest and resistance beyond social movements, beyond organizing, beyond sit-ins and marches, which putting those into conversation has pushed us to think about politics beyond the voting booth. And what Kelly says is there's resistance happening in the everyday, in the clothing choices that someone might make when they show up to work. He talks about being a high school student, and or he talks about others doing this, of giving away French fries while working in a fast food restaurant. That's resisting the exploitation that one was feeling as a worker there. And so we wanted to look at the hidden transcript of boxing, to look at the various ways that unknown boxers and media and others are using their different platforms and spaces that are under constant surveillance, that, as you noted, are controlled by some of the most abusive and exploitative cartels in history. And yet we can also find examples throughout history where resistance is happening, and not just at that major level, but in that everyday. That in many ways, showing up and refusing to cede this space that has long been seen as a space for the reaffirmation of white masculinity, that refusing that and or refusing to show up in ways that reaffirms a particular understanding of civility or discipline.
How do we understand boxing in the 21st century? Because on the other hand, as so many people comment, to the point of it being a cliche, it's a shadow of it was when you and I were growing up and we knew every middleweight and the welterweights and, you know, the Olympians, and obviously, you know, the heavyweight belt actually meant something and you knew who the champion was. Like, those days are dead. But at the same time, I think people who say that also have to reckon with the fact that, you know, 41 million people on Netflix watched Terrence Crawford and Canelo. I mean, it was incredible how many people saw that fight. And so for people to say boxing is dead, how can you even explain that? There were 70,000 people at Allegiant Stadium to see that fight. So where is boxing right now?
It's such an interesting question to me, because if you were to ask me that question maybe before the project, I would have been one to be like the same. I'll be like, hey, I remember growing up and pay-per-view was, you know, a not just a family thing, but what everyone did, and boxing, you know, Friday Night Lights and ABC's Wild World of Sports. And as you said, the 84 Olympics, where I can name, you know, talk about Mark Breland or Pernell Whitaker, and I would have said, hey, yeah, boxing is dead. And I think for me, the project and working with Rudy particularly opened my eyes and made me think, well, dead to whom? Because I think there's a positioning of there's an interesting dynamic, because I think the same people who are like, I can never watch boxing anymore, it's too violent and it's abusive and look who's running it, you know, organize their entire lives around the NFL. And so I find that to be kind of a rich, I just find it to be rich, like this idea that people have reconciled the contradictions in one space and another, they're like, I'm making a stand. And I do think if you look at, you know, the importance of boxing as a cultural space remains, as a space of intergenerational importance within families. That's clear. And I think one of the things the book does, and again, I'm going to keep dropping his name, that Rudy does in his work, is bring into light boxers who are important in communities, even if they're not, you know, in the big stadiums. And so, I mean, while Callie Reese has who's we have an interview with in the book, has blown up. Interestingly, the book has taken so long to come out. When we first interviewed Callie, we were primarily a boxer, and now we're well regarded Emmy, I think Emmy nominated actor for a number of shows, and so it the book highlights that they're individuals who are making impact among communities across the nation. It kind of reminds me, making me think of even conversations and both Jasiri and Stickman kind of in the book do this, is we can make similar comparisons to hip hop in that we, you know, in kind of thinking about Nas's song, which has been misunderstood of hip hop is dead. If we just turn on the radio or we just turn on award shows and see or look who's topping streaming, we would have a very narrow understanding of what is hip hop today. But if we look at the artists who are still, yes, they might have national resonance, that still resonate in communities, that are doing work, not just with their music, but with their activism, with businesses, with being kind of a cultural center in communities. I think that gives us a broader sense of that everyday resistance. Mm. And I think with the book, we try and do that both historically and in the contemporary. I mean, you mentioned the Olympics. We in the book highlight several boxers, including Palestinian boxers, including boxers who were questioned as to whether they were women, and noting that these very athletes, these very people, in their words, in the clothing that they were wearing, in their press conference, were refusing the narratives that were being hoisted upon them. Mm-hmm. Were refusing the injustice that they were seeing, not just in how they were treated, but what was happening to Palestinians, what was happening to transgender youth. So to me, those are the perfect examples of that everyday resistance, that then went on to the national, the global stage. And I guess I'll say this last thing about what struck me in doing research about Palestinian boxers, is we could look at their statements and their clothing and their refusal to keep politics out of the Olympics as their resistance. But what they had to go through in terms of training, you know, training with their, meeting with their trainer via Zoom because the trainer couldn't travel through checkpoints. To me, that is as much a story of resistance as the clothes they wore.
Amen. Well, David, I'm not going to let you go without first saying the book is Rings of Dissent, edited by Rudy Modragon, Gay Teresa Johnson, David J. Leonard, Boxing and Performances of Rebellion. The plural is important. It really is. Because as you talk about, there are layers of performance on boxing. The book's incredible. As I said at the top, I wrote the intro for it, which is a hell of an honor for me, honestly, because I really believe in you guys and the kind of work you want to put out. But I'm not letting you go without you telling me your favorite boxing book or work of writing.
Oh.
It doesn't have to be a book. Your favorite boxing, as long as it's nonfiction or fiction, I don't care. Just as your favorite, it could be a poem. Just your favorite boxing, anything that's the written word.
Wow.
And then your favorite boxing movie.
Okay, my favorite boxing movie.
In any order, as you've already decided.
Oh, no. Oh, you really got me. I love The Champ.
The Champ. Wow, you don't hear that one. I also love The Champ. Ryan O'Neal, Faye Dunaway, I believe. Ricky
Schroeder. I mean, Rick Schroeder. It's just, there's something about
it's a good movie.
A childhood a child. I just remember come back champ, come back champ.
And what about a book or poem or article even?
Um, I want to say, why am I going blank?
I have two big ones.
Yeah, you. I know. I think I know what's going to be your. Well, you tell me because I think I know what you're going to do.
Well, one, and I might surprise you, Baldwin on Sonny Liston is a big one for me. And Richard Wright on Joe Louis is a big one for
Oh,
me.
okay.
And then the book that I recommend everybody, of course, is Mike Marcusi's redemption song, Muhammad Ali in the 1960s.
Oh, see, I that's not where I thought you were going.
Where do you think I was going?
I thought you were gonna go, and that is what I was gonna say is Remnick's King of the World.
Oh, that's a classic, of course.
Yeah.
I just went with a different Ali book.
Yeah. I mean, I think I guess I can answer. Because obviously Norman Mailer's The Fight is a classic. But I'm ready. I can do this because I'm gonna I'll mention a few, but I gotta give love to a fellow contemporary of Teresa Rumsteather's book on Jack Johnson.
Terrific choice. Rebel Sojourner. What a
Yeah.
brilliant book.
Yeah. So I'm ready and I can do this.
Shout out,
At least
Teresa.
yes.
Well, yo, Dave, it's such a pleasure to talk to you. The book is Rings of Dissent, Boxing and Performances of Rebellion. Thanks so much for being with us here on the Edge of Sports podcast.
So thank you so much for having me. And I really appreciate your support over the many years.
Absolutely. We'll be back after a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, The Nation Magazine, and you can find out why I'm already backtracking on a finals pick. It just took one game. We'll be back right after this. We'll be back right after this with a quick word from Edge of Sports. Hey, everybody out there. This is Dave Zirin with the Edge of Sports podcast. People got to know that we put this podcast on with elbow grease and bubble gum on a weekly basis. And we're proud of the work that we do. We love it, but we can't do it without support from you, the listener. So please go to patreon.com/edgeofsportspod and support the podcast. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. Any little bit you might give to support the podcast actually makes a huge difference to the work we're trying to do. That's patreon.com/edgeofsportspod. We appreciate you. Make no mistake about it. And now, back to the Edge of Sports podcast. We are back on the Edge of Sports podcast. Thank you so much again to David Leonard. His book is called Rings of Dissent. It's really good. Boxing and politics. You know, we love that here. But now, as promised, we have part three of three of the preseason edition of Dave Z Talks to the Basketball Savant, Arya Shirazi. And we are going to talk to Ari about what we promised last week we were going to talk about, which is our awards picks. We're talking Coach of the Year. We're talking Most Improved Player. We're talking Defensive Player of the Year. We're talking Rookie of the Year. And we are talking the big dog, the MVP. Looking forward to having that talk with Ari. But before we do, we'd be really remiss to not just give our two cents about news that just broke today around a massive gambling scandal. It could end up being the biggest one we've seen in sports since 1919 and the Black Sox. We're talking about Chauncey Billups, the coach of the Portland Trail Blazers and NBA Hall of Famer, and Terry Rozier, a big time player with the Miami Heat, also roped in. Now, Arya, before I go to you, I want to just tell you, like, I read over, first of all, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
This news kind of sucks. I hate that. All right, I'm going to hit a couple of points here. The first is, I really do think, we don't have to get into it too deep, that Donald Trump and Kash Patel organized to drop this indictment the week of the opening of the NBA season for maximum effect. It's disgusting. It's the politics of retribution. It's because he views the NBA as an enemy. And I just want to say, fuck that dude. I love the NBA. And, you know, doing this to hurt a league that I care about really pisses me off. That's the first thing. Second thing is, Chauncey, dude. Like, you read this indictment, Shiraz. It's like Chauncey organized, along with Damon Jones, former NBA player, these card games that were run by four of the biggest mafia families in the United States. And they were the front people for it. And so they were cheating people in these card games with all kinds of crazy, like, spyware technology to read people's cards, to count cards, electronic shufflers, all these like crazy gadgets. And Billups and Damon Jones, particularly Billups, obviously, was like the face of the operation. And that's not good. And then the second thing is that Billups is named, although his name isn't really named, as doing what Terry Rozier was doing, which is, you know, really like trading on inside information about the team, fulfilling prop bets, which you and I should talk about those and how just corrosive they are. And I'm not going to say any commentary about that, except to say that this indictment, it's basically like, do you remember The Simpsons where it's like Lisa S? No, that's too obvious. L. Simpson. Like, the indictment says the unnamed player came into the league in 1997 and is currently a coach in the Western Conference. And it's like he's already been in the indictment as the casino guy. So it was just kind of a ridiculous shadow over C. Billups. Shiraz, general thoughts about this morass?
When this news dropped yesterday, you instantly called it politically motivated, or your sense was that it was politically controlled.
The timing.
At the highest level of government, as it were. And that makes a lot of sense to me, you know, the timing of it, you know, I mean, to ruin, you know, I mean, if you're an NBA fan, then this is the week you wait for all year. The opening, fuck the yeah. True opening of the NBA season is incredibly exciting. And this really, this news really kind of ruins a lot of that. I have not dived down into the details about the indictments at all. Kind of one of my first thoughts after just being really disappointed for those guys. One of my first thoughts was, wait, so who's going to be coaching the Trailblazers in the interim? But, you know, but that aside, I mean, this almost certain, however it plays out in courts, I'd be surprised if this doesn't end Billups' coaching career.
Yeah.
And without knowing anything, that sucks.
Yeah.
It might be that information comes out that makes me like Chauncey as a person less. but since I haven't allowed that to happen yet, I'm really bummed for him. And, you know, and this probably ends Terry Rozier's career. And, you know, obviously we could talk for a long time on this, and mercifully we won't. But in a nutshell, ever since I learned what prop bets were, I thought it was really gross. You know, I mean, the idea, it's probably what people love. You can bet on absolutely everything. Isn't that the greatest? Isn't that uber capitalism? You can bet on every single possession, every single thing that happens in a sporting contest can be profit for people. Of course we're there, but it fucking sucks. I mean, as I said, the notion of prop bets, of the over under on every player's season averages, right? I mean, isn't that just like an open invitation to say to play 9 minutes and say, oh, I just don't feel right today.
And you can
So
bet
that
on
you're
such
under on all of
specific
your stats,
things.
and then the next game you're fresh as a daisy. So
Yes.
I mean the entire I like sports without gambling. And since gambling is pervasive in sports, this is gonna happen. But it affects me more and affects the league more when it's Chauncey Billups and Terry Rozier than when it's Jontay Porter. He enabled to be a punchline. This is takes real players and people out of the game and might just be the very beginning
Exactly. I
of
mean,
this kind of stuff. So,
why wouldn't it be? But you just said it. It's so pervasive. Every damn commercial, and it's also like these players, like inside information. This is one of the things that gambling's ruined. Like, if you're a player and your buddy is just like, how is everything? And you just say, ah, we're fucking tanking. And that buddy puts money on the other team and makes it. You are effectively now liable for cheating because it's viewed as passing on inside information intentionally or otherwise. I mean, if there wasn't gambling, it would just be you talking to a buddy. You know what I'm saying? Like it's criminalized the way these players can even express themselves to the people around them, because everything has to be under lock and key. So, Jaylen Brown can have a $715 million contract. I mean, the revenue streams, and I like Jaylen Brown a lot, but it's just the revenue streams are so addictive to them that they don't care that young people are in record numbers calling these gambling hotlines, that it's really screwing with kids' brains, and that at the end they say 1-800-GAMBLER and you can get help. I don't know, man. I guess we're already taking too much time on this. It's just really hard for me to, go after the minnows when these whales, these NBA owners are just making billions and billions off the gambling industry.
That's unfortunately the way of world history.
And
Very
such is
rare,
this.
very rarely are the, rarely are the whales ever kind of, held to account.
That's why we love Ahab. Let me go to break right now. You know what, Arya? I gotta clean the palate a little bit. We can do a quick word from the Nation magazine, perhaps one celebrating our 160th birthday coming up on October 30th, where I'm gonna be speaking at this event in St. Anne's Warehouse. And I can get certain buddies there for free if they wanna go or not. We'll be back right after this. I guess I killed two birds with one stone. I wanted to tell you about the event and was. All right. So I'm going to do a little lead in and then we'll just do it.
Cool.
All right. We are back on the Edge of Sports podcast and we are going to tell you our NBA award winners, Arya Shirazi, the basketball savant, and me, Dave Z. Before we get into this, Ari, quick thing. I am going to take a mulligan on something I said with my predictions. I'm backtracking. And you know what? A lot of people will say, you're backtracking after seeing one of the games. That's not pure, dude. And I'm just like, we just spoke about Chauncey Billups. Don't tell me about pure. I'll do what I want. At least I'm not making it a wager. Yeah. And I'm doing this as a tribute to my nephew, Izzy. Because I introduced Izzy over the weekend to the movie Scarface, Brian De Palma's Scarface, written by Oliver Stone, Pacino. Arya, I don't think we've ever had this discussion. What do you think about Scarface? We've talked about so many movies. I have no memory of talking to you about Scarface.
Scarface has taken on epic symbolism. And Scarface was a film that kind of spawned its own philosophy, as it were, you know, and honestly, as a young brown person growing up uptown, Tony Montana really kind of became, in a way, kind of the ideal for a certain kind of lifestyle and a certain kind of immigrant dream. And what I think was unforeseen or has actually surprised me is that 40 years later, Tony Montana and that character as Pacino played him, is as popular and as kind of as in the public consciousness than ever, for many of those same reasons that he initially became kind of the ultimate example of a certain kind of striving. I myself never aspired to be Tony Montana.
You didn't want that scar across your face,
you know, and I haven't come close. So I guess that's been a success. And also funny because the movie has great, great stuff and some really absurd stuff as well, which makes it kind of classic Brian De Palma.
Yes. It doesn't get looked at through that lens enough. That it's a De Palma film. Like when people name their favorite De Palma films, no one ever says, I think a lot of people think of it as an Oliver Stone film because it is so sort of over the top and coked up, and people associate that with Stone. Although there's a lot of De Palma in the movie. I mean, some great scenes of suspense.
Oh, I think De Palma has his fingerprints on it more than just about anybody. And the last I'll say on Scarface, again, a very, very kind of influential film, past its artistic merits, is I'm pretty sure it was the film that introduced me to Michelle Pfeiffer. So for that alone, I am forever indebted.
Oh my God. Yes. Although I first saw her in Grease too. And of course, smitten immediately. But yep. But wow, what a pink lady. I'm sorry, Stockard Channing. So here's something that I've always felt very lucky about is I saw Scarface before. It was my first Pacino. Like I'd never seen the Godfather movies the first time I saw Scarface. And so I had no fixed Pacino in my mind. I didn't even know that he wasn't Cuban, you know? So I remember, none of the self-parody stuff was part of my first impression. And I think Pacino is fucking brilliant in this movie. I'm sorry. Like, I know people make fun, but he's fucking brilliant. Tony Montana, for God's sakes. It's like one of the most iconic screen names in the history of the medium. But this is why I'm mentioning it. There's a line in Scarface where, and I won't do the accent, is he says, "All I have is my word and my balls, and I'm not going to break them for nobody." Well, I don't want to break my word, and I don't want to break my balls by not being honest. And in all honesty, all I want to do is pick the Houston Rockets to make it to the NBA Finals against the New York Knicks. So I said Denver last week. I'm renouncing that pick. Şengün had a Euro basket and an opening game, I'm being honest, where he dropped over 40, where you're just thinking to yourself, wow. Because people were saying over the summer, Şengün has leveled up. They were calling him Baby Jokic. Things like that. And I was just like, okay, sometimes players do level up. That does happen in this league, certainly. And Şengün's really young. I don't know, man. Durant, I think Amen Thompson and Reed Shepard can be Fred VanVleet enough for the offense to run. I'm all Houston, man. Houston Knicks in the finals. That's my prediction, and I'm really sticking to it.
I like that you were inspired to inspired by a to promote a new team after they opened with a double overtime loss.
Yes.
So I think there's some integrity behind that pick.
Thank you. I mean, it's almost like okay, they lost, but proof of concept. Ooh, I like what I see. Steven Adams can never beat up too many people for me over the course of an NBA game. He's a guy who could, I'm going to sound very old, but he's a guy who could have played in the 80s. Steven Adams, like a Pistons bad boy center or something. Like, I like him very much.
He's like the only player in the league you can liken to a bad boy.
Wow. Well, no, no, no.
That's why he stands out.
I bet we would. This is actually would be a very interesting game. Like, who today could really be a bad boy? I think Isaiah Stewart, Beef Stew.
Oh yeah, him too. He's a very angry dude. He was minimally skilled, so he would fit. Yeah,
he would be perfect. Right
in. Yeah, that's very true.
The Rick Mahorn of his age. Yeah. But let me throw. We could talk. Oh, that actually would be a fun game for maybe for next week. Or another week, or whenever the hell I can drag you back here.
After our listeners will just have to be waiting with bated breath for that one.
Yes. So first one, Aria, you're going to go first this time. We could actually reverse it, where I go two in a row, and then you go two in a row. So we mix it up a little bit. But we're going to start with you. Do you think is going to be the coach of the year in the NBA in 25-26?
Yeah, last year I thought Kenny Atkinson deserved it, and there were five or six other coaches that I also thought deserved it. I thought there were some really fabulous coaching jobs last year which were notable to me, which kind of elevated the teams that they had. Because of that, it's because so many coaches, I think, elevated their respective teams. This year, it's a little bit harder to forecast in that department a little bit. But I am going to go with Nick Nurse.
Whoa.
Of the Sixers.
Whoa.
We talked about the Sixers, or I talked about them when we discussed the East last week. Even more than Milwaukee, they are almost an impossible team to project. Because of the current and prospective injury absences. And how the absences or complete health and availability of those key players can swing the fortunes of that team so drastically.
Well, can I counter though with something?
Sure.
I obviously you don't make massive predictions and thoughts based upon one game, but I found the opening game, Sixers beating the Celtics, notable, not just because of Edgecombe, the rookie, looking like he's 27 years old, but Embiid goes, I think, 1 for 9, just a shell. Paul George doesn't play, and yet there's still, you almost like this team can win 50 games with next to nothing from those guys. I really believe that. I think there's so much talent on the perimeter that if those guys stay healthy, and if Edgecombe is for real, and I think he is, then I think that Embiid and George almost become luxuries, and that's okay. They can still succeed that way. That's what I got out of that first game.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly why ultimately I'm pegging Nurse for this award, because pardon me, while George and to a greater extent Embiid are the keys to where the Sixers can ultimately take their season, and if they are a viable championship contender at all, though, it is going to depend largely on those guys. But as you said, outside of them, the cupboard is certainly not bare. And it gets kind of very interesting, the looks that they can have when they're not trying to base a team around Embiid. So I think because of that, I think that it's a fair bet that Embiid and or George will be in and out of the lineup all year. And I think that Nurse is going to stabilize that team to be a to win more than they lose, even with the inevitable uncertainty and unavailability, and have them in a position so that if Embiid and George are able in the second half of the season to look somewhat like them, we'll be elevating what has already been a solid team. So because expectations are so iffy or downright low, I think Nurse is going to do a really good coaching job this year for Philly.
I like it. My prediction is somebody who I think a lot of people want to vote for because he's had a lot of respect for a long time as a coach, but because largely of injuries and really bad front office work that finally looks stabilized, he actually has a team this year that could blow past 50 games. And I think people are going to want to vote for this guy because of the respect he holds. And I'm talking about Quinn Snyder of the Atlanta Hawks. I think that one of the things he's done that I didn't think would happen is that it really looks like he's convinced Trae Young to not be Trae Young, meaning thinking much more of not being a ball stopper, meaning much more of getting the ball into the hands of some of these young guys, and being a leader more than anything else. Like he's the old sage on this team, Trae Young. And I think that it's exciting to think about what the Hawks are going to do this year. They are one of those teams. I'll repeat what you said about the Sixers, where I'm really hoping injuries aren't the way we define their season. And I'm really talking about Jalen Johnson. I just like watching him play so much. But I think they're deep enough now to withstand some of that in a way they haven't been in years past. Their depth will lead to success, and Quinn Snyder will be rewarded by his peers, who I think have wanted to reward him for some time.
I have had no idea that Quinn Snyder was so revered by his coaching brethren, actually. I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know that anybody felt a certain way about him. So that is actually news to me. I didn't know that he was so respected among the coaching fraternity. Yeah, he's got a. If I were Trae Young, I would bristle at being called a ball stopper. Trae Young just led the league in assists.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Right. So that kind of runs counter to the idea of being a player where the ball stops in their hands. Then again, James Harden also kind of fit that description. I think he led the league in assists and also was somebody who sometimes the offense really ground to a halt while he did. And I know that I think Trey has some of that too, but not necessarily to that extent. Yeah, if the Hawks are as good as I and many other people, yourself, think that they should be or could be, then Quinn might get a lot of credit for that.
That'd be awesome. All right, so I guess the way we said we'd do it is now I would go first. The next one was most improved player, and you know what? This is going to be a wild one. But I'm going to go with somebody who I believe may have won it already. I need to check that because that would be really crazy. But I'm going with Mikal Bridges. I know a little out of the box, but sometimes that's what happens. I think there, you know me, Ari. I'm narrative addicted. It's just the way I look at the game. I admit that it leads me sometimes to do say and do absurd things. But there is definitely a real narrative, not one I made up, that last year was kind of a season from hell for Mikal Bridges. He was miserable, couldn't deal with Tibbs, no real role in the offense, and they just traded 5 first-round picks for him. So just this like disastrous season where, he was starting to become, before some playoff heroics, even a bit of a scapegoat. And I just think he's going to flourish under Mike Brown. And I think people are going to, and the Knicks are going to be outstanding. And there's going to be a narrative about kind of a Bridges unlocking that will lead him to be the most improved player.
I guess this is the toughest one for me, actually. And even like while you were talking Bridges, like my mind was kind of racing as far as like, oh, who do I think? And I'm gonna go with kind of an obvious one, but I'm gonna go with Reed Sheppard. Because I'm not necessarily on the Rockets are going to the finals trolley, even if it would not totally surprise me. But I do believe that Reed is going to be a very good player in the league. I don't think that ultimately his draft placement is going to be questioned or ridiculed. And now is the time to step up. Now is absolutely the time. If Shepard steps in to the role vacated by Van Vliet and Houston looks like a threat to win the West or come out of the West all year, then I think Shepard will need to be a big part of it. And the very little I've seen of him, the skills at least look like he's definitely got it in him. I this is the toughest one for me. I just didn't have an answer I really liked. Like I was trying to think like, ooh, is there like a player that I've been thinking or saying is gonna make a leap? And I just couldn't, nobody jumped out at me. I know that I had been circling Shepherd and Dillingham as two young point guards who their teams would really, really like them to make a huge leap from a tough rookie season. And I was thinking Dillingham, but I think that that Shepherd is going to get a chance to play major minutes earlier, and I'm thinking that he's going to show that he's capable of handling that on a team whose ambitions are sky high.
Wow. I can't lie to you, man. I thought that was stronger than I thought it would be. When you said Reed Sheppard, I think that's a very good logic. I think it's interesting that neither of us said two of the people who are at the top of all the predictions that people are trying to make.
Who are people predicting?
One of the two Thompson twins. And like some people are into that Ausar will have a little bit more space to develop. Amen is going to be under the spotlight because of taking some of Van Vliet's load is their plan. And I think Amen is, I don't think he's going to win it, but I think he's going to be a defensive player of the year finalist. So a lot of people are looking at them. I still think, I'm such fans and have been from jump, but I think a year away. Another year, please. Ausar missed a lot of time last year with the thrombosis. And Amen is going to have to adjust in a way now that was unexpected in the offseason. So we'll see. But that's my take.
I guess I don't really totally get this award. And in general, I've actually not been that interested in this award because, right, like to me, like the Thompsons, they're already good. And right, that's right. Most improved is taking your game to a different level. So, right, Mikal Bridges, who's a very kind of known entity, can still get better or show that he is better than he was last year, and that's improvement. So you're right. I mean, to me, I guess I'm always looking at a player who hasn't made a name for himself yet, who is going to now be a factor. Everybody's talking about the Thompsons already as important ingredients on emerging teams. So I guess it's like, sure, I guess that is like what people vote for, but I always tend to think of who is going to emerge as a factor in this league. Thompson's already are major factors.
Do you know why you hate this award?
Hate is a strong word.
All right. Well, do you know why I hate this award?
Oh, why?
How about that?
Why?
Because it is some just say no to drugs, Nancy Reagan bullshit that it even exists. Because the award used to be called
Comeback
the
Player of the
Comeback Player
Year,
of
of
the Year.
course.
And it
It was
kept getting
drug
won
rehab
by,
or torn knees. Those were the only two comebacks.
it kept getting won by Michael Ray Richardson.
Yeah, I think he won like 4 out of 5 years. And right, for Nancy, she was like, no go.
He was like the Bill Russell of that award. And so, you know, that's that that's they got rid of it 'cause it made Nancy Reagan upset. And now it's this crap fucking shit. All
Wow,
right.
I did not realize you had such strong feelings. Next year, Dave, we can just pretend that it doesn't exist.
A little late for this year. All right, you're up, big man. Rookie of the Year. An award I actually care about.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Cooper Flagg is going to win Rookie of the Year. I think that he is going to have to show that he is such a good player that ultimately he is going to win Rookie of the Year. So on the record, it's that. Being the having the benefit of recording this show after every team has played a game already, clearly Vijay Edgecombe, who I had already spoken highly about when upping the Sixers in our East preview, Edgecombe had like one of the great one of the great NBA debuts. So and now is looking like, oh, if that's kind of the player he is, then he and Maxey in the backcourt is going to be nutso. Ultimately, I think that it is going to be Flagg. I think he's going to have the best rookie year and going to be the best player for years to come out of this class. But Philly should be really, really excited
Look.
about what Edgecombe showed in his first regular season game.
Look, you know, we can't pretend, Shiraz, that we're in some kind of time machine and don't know what's already happened the first couple of games. So of course I'm picking Vijay Edgecombe. I mean, he's unbelievable player. You know, I kept thinking of this thing that Greg Anthony said about like the ball knows where it's supposed to go. 'Cause I it was actually something I interviewed Greg Anthony and I asked him, this was like the first year of the Heatles. And I said, what if Dwayne Wade and LeBron James are like fighting over shots? It seems weird to have two wings like that who are used to getting the ball first. And he said, the ball will end up where it's supposed to go. And I thought about that watching the highlights of that Sixers game because my reason for not picking Edgecombe going into this pod before I saw that game was, oh, there are too many wings on the Sixers. They're too rich in wings. I mean, Brent Grimes will average more points than Edgecombe. You know, that was my thinking that he would be, it would be like a pecking order, you know, and he's this very young rookie. And yet the ball knew last night where it was supposed to go. You know, in his hands, and him scoring over most points for a rookie game since Wilt Chamberlain in 1959. The ball knew where to go. So, of course, I'm picking Edgecombe. He looks like a generational talent, and I don't think it's bullshit, especially not when you're being guarded by people, you know, The dude who is primarily guarding him on the Celtics,
Derek
Derek
White.
White.
Yeah.
Like Derek White, one of our best defenders, a
The
guy who was
slumming
on the
guy.
Olympics team just because he could defend, basically. And he's a good locker room guy. Whatever. Sorry, so that's my pick, Edgecombe. I'm not going to pretend I didn't see that first game.
Dave, you were also a good locker room guy.
Thank you. Thank you. I tried. You got to contribute where you can. All right, we're at the big one, guy. MVP.
Ooh, we're there already. I really kind of tipped my hand last week when we were talking about our finals.
Oh, we didn't do Defensive Player of the Year.
Let's
That's why it's
let's do
incorrect.
that. Defensive player of the year.
But now what I'm gonna do is get my man Dave Tigaboo to edit out this whole part. And I'm gonna say 3, 2, 1. Okay, we got one more before we do the MVP. And that's Defensive Player of the Year. I believe this is me first this time. And I really was searching for a way to not pick Wembanyama. I really was. I didn't want to be that obvious. I was trying to think of, is there a way that Amen Thompson will be such a defensive demon, or people will say Dyson Daniels deserved it last year, which he did. Let's give it to him as a makeup. And then Wembanyama, there is the health question, of course, but my God, he is a swallower of worlds out there, and he gets steals. He's the best block steal guy I've seen since Hakeem Olajuwon. I'm not saying he's ahead of Hakeem by any stretch. He's got years of work to put in that regard. But just his ability to stat pile on both the block and steals question, my God, I'm going Wemby. I don't care if it's obvious. I think I've had some good ultra picks in this episode, so I'm not ultra on this one. I'm going Wemby.
I have been a little bit irritated over what I perceived as the basketball community or the sports community or whatever, just tripping over themselves to anoint Wembanyama. Again, I think I already said this on your show, but it seemed like people just want him to get awards so badly. They can't just let him be a young player. He needs to get awards. And so I was fully intending to name Dyson Daniels as my defensive player, totally because of what he did last year. I don't know if it's possible to have as great a defensive season, at least by the numbers, as he did last year. I think it'd be reasonable maybe that those would fall off a little bit, especially because the entire league knows that he's the best thief out there. But I do believe that Daniels is the best perimeter defender in the league as well as help defender. So I was fully expecting to name Daniels as my defensive player of the year. And then I watched some of the Spurs opening game. And I guess I just haven't actually seen Victor play that much, which makes sense because a player really needs to be in the league 3 or 4 years for me to get interested in them. Actually, I like veterans. I'm not somebody who loves watching the hot rookie. Again, you need to be in the league a little while. For me to kind of, like focus on a player. So I just haven't seen that much of Victor in his first couple of years. I haven't been watching the Spurs because I did not realize that he is literally everywhere. It
Yeah.
is not, I mean, it is not fair for a person to be that height in that body and have that game.
And those
And I
feet.
know that I'm late to this. I know that's what's made him, but I see it now. I mean, Yao Ming was a singular force, and his game could not be more different than Victor at the same height. Victor on offense looks like he can't be guarded, and on defense, kind of looks like if he's in the area, how do you get a shot off? He blocked a shot yesterday where it looked like he was looking in the other direction
Yeah.
and just put his hand up and pinned the thing. So it makes no difference who I think is going to get the award, but I do now see why people who squawk about this stuff are saying that Wembanyama is a different kind of defensive force than has existed, because I have now seen the light and I believe that too.
Amen, amen. And something that isn't statistically quantifiable is something I saw several times. I watched the whole Dallas Spurs, and so many times you had a Dallas player, 'cause they got the big dudes like PJ Washington, Anthony Davis, Cooper Flagg. These are big guys, and they would dribble down and have their defender on their hip, a play they've probably done a trillion times in their life, and Victor would show up. And then they would just pivot around and throw it back out to the perimeter. There's no way to statistically measure that, but it's also about like big guys choosing not to shoot easy shots, just making that choice and not wanting to be embarrassed. So we're up to the MVP, buddy. This one's you.
I tipped my hand on this previously when we were talking about our finals picks, but I am going all in on Luka Doncic
Wow.
this year. And I have picked him before. And as I said, and this might sound actually a little dramatic because he has so much ball ahead of him, but I almost feel like this is kind of in a way the last year for him to be considered like that. I think even 2 years ago, certainly three, the notion that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander would get an MVP before Luka was a major long shot. And now I think it's conventional wisdom that I subscribe to that Gilgeous was the justifiable MVP and Jokic is the no doubt best player in the world. So, and I think even a couple of years ago when Dallas made their run to the final, I think any conversation of the best included Luka on that short list. And over the course of one traumatic season, I think that he's kind of dropped from that rarefied conversation. I have high hopes and expectations for the Lakers this year, the highest. I think they're going to win the championship. And I think LeBron is maybe going to play his fewest games ever, or at least is going to have some extended periods out of the lineup. I think Luka is going to show that he is unquestionably the franchise player of that team now, resulting in team success. And I think that that he is going to show himself to be right back in the conversation of the two or three best players in the entire league, and I'm choosing him to be MVP.
Love it. No notes. No notes whatsoever. I'm going to actually do something similar to you in that I'm going to pick a team that I was really high on, and I'm going to say that I think their best player is going to be the MVP. And I think the MVP is going to be Giannis Antetokounmpo on a surprising Bucks team. I think even if they're like the way I see it, like a four seed with, between 48 and 52 wins, people are going to look at the fact that he's doing it with basically a bunch of shooters and Miles Turner. And last year he averaged 30, 12, and 7, which is not that far off of what Jokic does. And I think there is a little Jokic fatigue, and there'll be an appreciation of the fact that unlike Jokic, Giannis is a balls-out defender, and Jokic is a better defender than people give him credit for. But I do think this is about Giannis, you know, really making a play for the throne at this point in his career. I mean, why not? So I'm Giannis Antetokounmpo. I thought he was a generational player when they won that title. I was shocked that they didn't repeat. And I'm ready for the return of the Giannissance. Ooh, I made that up. The Giannissance.
Milwaukee is so hard for me to forecast what they're going to be, what they're going to look like. I really love that pick, actually. And
thank you.
It would be incredibly impressive for him to get the MVP after Jokic has gotten three and Gilgeous has gotten one, since Antetokounmpo won back-to-back.
Right.
Because of what Jokic has accomplished and Gilgeous doing it in a championship season, Giannis's back-to-back MVPs is a long time ago now.
Distant memory.
So for him to not only show that he's, you know, the best player in the conference, but win an MVP, win another, a third most valuable player, taking a team, that to me is made up of fairly unimpressive parts. Yeah. And if he can turn that team into a contender, then that's MVP stuff.
Yeah, it really is. And I'm not even that big a fan of Miles Turner, but having another rim protector who can also shoot 40% from three, maybe that's a recipe for something.
Bucks should have a great defense.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Great defense.
They're going to be one of my my league pass teams. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Arya Shiraz, thanks so much, man. We're going to get back in regularly and chop up where we are in the season, if that's all right with thou.
It's very much all right, man. Looking forward to talking to you on a variety of topics throughout the next many months.
Yo, for everybody out there listening, thank you to The Nation Magazine, 160 years old. Please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.